This is Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. If you knew that it cost, say, $2,000 less to get your hip replaced at one hospital than another, would that sway your decision on where to get the surgery? Or is price too narrow a scope? Maybe you also want to know about a doctor's success rate and patient clientele, and you may want to know what kind of rates your insurance company has negotiated with different hospitals. It all gets very complicated very quickly. But the bottom line, according to State Auditor Doug Hoffer, is that Vermont needs to do a better job at making the costs of medical procedures at different healthcare facilities more transparent. That's the upshot of a new report the auditor's office released last week. Today on the program, we're going to talk about what the report says and then hear from others about how this might work. The Green Mountain Care Board says it is going to revamp a database the state already has that records insurance claims. The board says it should eventually be able to be used by the public. We're also going to hear about where some say this kind of database of prices might still fall short of truly informing patients. Plus, would it do anything to curb healthcare costs on a larger scale? First up today, State Auditor Doug Hoffer. Nice to talk with you.
Good to be here, Jane. Thanks.
What is the law that says that the state of Vermont has to provide or provide a platform or provide a way for consumers to be able to know price data?
I think the citation is 18 VSA 9410, but that's not really what
you
want.
Yeah, very helpful.
But among other things, back in, I think, 09, the legislature, I think wisely, identified a number of things that they needed and that regulators needed to make better decisions going forward. And this was before they decided to do single payer. And they specifically asked for six particular duties. At that time, I think it was BSHCA, the Department of Banking, Insurance, Securities, and Healthcare, which then morphed in part into the Department of Financial Regulation.
Mm-hmm.
Subsequently, a year ago, these particular responsibilities were given to the Green Mountain Care Board. And there were six, as I say. Five of them were really for researchers and analysts and policymakers. But there was one that was specific to the needs of consumers, and they asked that VQRS, this database, this remarkable and very large, somehow unwieldy database, provide information to consumers about the costs of medical products and procedures.
Yeah, so the state is requiring that Vermont consumers should be able to have information about healthcare procedures and to be able to compare the costs between different procedures and different places and the approach to care.
I don't think the legislature was that detailed. I think they simply said in broad terms, provide more and better information to consumers. Now, other states have similar databases. They're called all-payer databases, and that is to say that the information comes from insurance companies for virtually every procedure, about 90% of the private sector, and now, in addition, Medicare and Medicaid. So it's an incredibly robust data set with an awful lot of data for the last 7 years or so.
Yeah, maybe you can explain that. The state does have this database, and as you said, it's called VQRS, and that stands for the Vermont Healthcare Uniform Reporting and Evaluation System, and it's been in place for 7 years. What's it actually collecting?
The insurance companies are required to submit this information to a third party, a contractor paid by the state. I think they're called OnPoint at present. And this information is all encrypted. The insurance companies take away the opportunity for anyone to see that it's your information or mine. And that, I think, is part of what, just as an aside, what the board's going to be doing with VQRS 2.0, which is addressing some of the issues about security. In effect, maybe providing, I think their intent was to provide more information about individuals so that they can be tracked over time, which this one isn't as useful for. But that aside, this is a huge amount of information, as you would imagine, and every procedure and product has a code. And actually, I don't think there's anyone in state government, a state employee, who is sufficiently trained or skilled to use this data. So mostly it's consultants and contractors, which is fine. And the third party holds it. Other parties either contracted to the board directly for their own purposes, those other five duties indicated by the statute, or folks outside of Vermont, for example, that want access to it, they have to sign a data use agreement and an affidavit to protect the data and provide the information once developed back to the board. So it's a little complicated, not user-friendly at the present, but that wasn't its intent at the outset. I think the board recognizes that it is a responsibility that they have to get there sooner or later, and we hope this conversation will move it forward.
I'm talking right now with State Auditor Doug Hoffer about a report that came out of his office last week that details where the state is falling short in its obligation to help consumers be informed about medical procedures and their costs in order to give them more flexibility, perhaps, in determining where and how to get medical care. Listeners, if you have questions about this, how it works so far, what might happen with with this revamped database that we've been talking about, you can call 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211. And let us know, would this change your decisions? What would change your decisions? What do you need to have in a database that would be helpful to you as you make medical decisions? You can post those thoughts at vpr.net. So, State Auditor Doug Hoffer, this database, the VCures, currently has all of the insurance claims that have been paid out over the last 7 years. Does it also have the charge rates, what hospitals charge, and then what they've negotiated with the insurance companies?
All of that can be done with this system, and that, of course, is the major advantage because the charge rate is not what we pay. We all have different copays and deductibles, and ideally, the system will allow us to go in. The system will recognize not necessarily who we are, but what our situation is. And in the end, you can come away saying, oh, I need a colonoscopy. It's going to cost me this much.
Right, because right now you might get a bill from the hospital or you might get a statement from the hospital or from your insurance company that says this procedure cost $10,000, but your insurance is going to pay out $7,000, and that's all that we're going to charge because that's the negotiated rate we have with your insurance. So the cost to the patient is zero, or whatever the cost to the patient may be.
Right.
And all of that gets very complicated. So as you said, VCures, the current database, very unwieldy. So from your perspective, looking into this database, exactly how is the state falling short? Could anybody really use it?
No, I don't think so. I mean, first you'd have to go to the trouble to have a data use agreement with the board. And, you know, lay people can't do that. It's not intended for those purposes. That's for analysts. But, you know, the board, for its part, has only had this responsibility for a year. They have a great deal on their plate. They have limited resources, but they've chosen, for their own reasons, not to focus on this or make this a priority. They know it needs to be done. I hope they do it sooner rather than later. Fallen short, maybe a bit harsh, but...
Well, it is a statutory obligation, you said.
No question about it, but it's only been a year. But they haven't really planned as of yet as to how to do it, when to do it, in what form. There are some models. There was one in particular, New Hampshire. Now, they didn't do a full-blown system, but they did manage to get a website up for individuals who could go to the site and say, well, tell me who does this procedure within 50 miles and what it's going to cost me. And I think they did it for 30 or 40 fairly common procedures. And as it turned out, a lot of people weren't using it, but reporters were using it. And they reported some differences in prices around the state, which led to a bit of a conflict between the largest insurer and the most expensive hospital in the state. And the upshot of that was that some prices were either moderated from what their increases would have been otherwise or actually declined, which is kind of interesting. So once they were, you know, outed, as it were, they made some changes in how they did business. But to be clear, the academic literature and other also says very clearly that simply giving people price information is not sufficient. They really do need quality information. And that's a big issue that is not, I think there are people working on it. I know there are people working on it, but we're not close on that. In the meantime, we can get the dollar stuff up and running if we choose to.
We got a note from Mark who posts online to say, one problem with price transparency is the lack of apples-to-apples quality comparison between common procedures performed at different facilities, which is what you've just been talking about.
Right.
Mark goes on to say, this would be 100% necessary in order for healthcare consumers to make educated choices about where to purchase services. Mr. Hoffer, where is this apples-to-apples quality data going to come from? Mark also provided links to two studies on price and quality transparency that he had found.
But both of those reports, I believe, are cited in our report,
yes.
By the way. My researcher found both of them. Where is it going to come from? Everybody has to be involved. All the providers, those are independent, those that work in hospitals, everybody has to be engaged. People themselves have to be surveyed in some way to report their satisfaction. You know, if you're talking about performance measures, you can't ignore how the people themselves who are the recipients of these services feel. So it's quite complicated. It's going to take time. I don't think the board is focused on that as yet, but there are other parties around the state beginning to talk about it. Now, the hospitals, as I understand it, have some performance data, but I think it's really geared towards their operations and how they evaluate their own performance internally.
Don't they also have to meet certain obligations in terms of performance in order to get certain federal dollars? So might that be incorporated?
With CMS, that may well be the case. I'm not familiar with that.
So did you look at what it might cost to actually get something like this up and running in the state?
It's difficult to say. It depends in part on how much you want the system to provide. The one in New Hampshire was done at a relatively modest cost, but again, they only had 30 or 40 common procedures, but that's better than nothing. And furthermore, they chose those common procedures because so many people use them. I think they did it for low six figures, like $100,000. Now, New Hampshire is down right now. Their system is not up. They switched contractors, and then they had some trouble with the quality of the data, so they shut down until they can figure it out. But I expect they'll be back up.
You said a couple times that you don't think the board, the Green Mountain Care Board, which has been charged with making this happen, has been particularly focused on it in the past, but they have said they will revamp this database. They're looking at contractors who might be able to do that kind of thing. Do you have a timeline that you think is reasonable?
Well, you said they're looking for a contractor who might do that sort of thing. I think they're not looking for a contractor to do what we're discussing right now.
Mm.
They're looking for a contractor who may be the same one we have now, but I think they're going out with an RFP for, in effect, 2.0. In part, some of the issues I just alluded to earlier about the nature of the IDs that are provided or not and how they're encrypted or not and when and whether we can track people over time, that's a big part of it, but it's their RFP, not mine. But I don't believe that RFP really addresses this question head on.
So do you think there is a timeline that you have in mind, or is this sort of up to whatever we decide?
It's not my place to set the board's timeline, but I know that the chairman of the board indicated that he thought it would take years.
Let's go to a call. Raman is calling in from Morrisville. Hi, Raman. Go ahead.
Hey, yeah. I have, in addition to my job as a programmer, a retired programmer, I'm 65 years old. I also manage a pediatric practice for the past 30 years. This is my wife's practice. I have had my own frustration with the health system. But right now, my suggestion is, we talk about Oracle, we talk this database, we talk that database. My sincere suggestion, I also have participated in various hackathons in Boston, in New York City. My sincere suggestion is scrub the data of identifying people, you know, the private information, scrub the data, remove it, leave everything alone, and put it in a cloud in a public space, and let the bunch of hackathons chew on it with the various hackathons, and they will make sense of it, and they will make it much more user-friendly, so on and so forth.
Raman, thanks for that. I appreciate that perspective, and Vermont does have that Civic Day, or National Day of Civic Hacking. Maybe that's something that we could look into. What do you think, Auditor?
Why not?
So, you know, that idea, though, of open source data, I mean, you did talk about, and Raman talks about, scrubbing all of the identifiable data, and that is obviously a concern, that security concern would have to be involved in making this accessible to people.
Indeed, and there's another point. It's not just this data. Ultimately, if it were to be done the way it would be most useful to you and me and your listeners is that the website, such as it were, would have to include information to identify your policy. So that ultimately, after it crunched all the numbers and said, yes, this procedure at this facility would cost X, but then you have a copay, you have a deductible. In the end, the only thing, not the only thing, but the thing that's most important to you is how much for you. So there would be a lot more information than what's currently in VCures.
Before we let you go, we're going to move on and talk about this with some other constituencies that are involved in trying to think about healthcare data. But before we let you go, you also in your report brought in the fact that Vermonters are taking on more of the potential costs of their healthcare costs, even with insurance. And you talk about high deductible healthcare plans in particular. Can you just sort of drill down on what you were looking at there?
Yeah, the point is there's a couple of aspects of this. One is that the nature of high deductible plans has changed over time. The deductible itself has risen. More and more people have those plans for a variety of reasons, mostly cost, I think. So to the extent that consumers have more responsibility for more of the cost of these procedures and products, it's not surprising that they express more interest in getting information up front about, well, what is it going to cost? Where can I get it? How good is it? You know, how many times have they done this procedure over here and over there? In addition, I think forgive me, I'm a bit older than you are, but I remember a time when, and there's still some of this to a large extent, that if your doctor told you to do something, that's all you need to hear. The trust was very, very strong, and it should be. If they now recommend a procedure, however, I think we've been through a major change in this country, and an awful lot of people want to ask more questions. They want to be more engaged in their own healthcare decisions, so they need and deserve more information.
That is State Auditor Doug Hoffer. Thank you very much for illuminating what's in your report.
Thank you, Jane.
Coming up, we're going to get more perspective on how a database might be used by consumers and perhaps whether or not it could help drive down health care costs. Chime in if you have a question or a thought on that. You can post a note on the Vermont Edition page at vpr.net or call 1-800-639-2211. I'm Jane Lindholm, and this is Vermont Edition. Today, we're discussing the idea of a database that would disclose the prices for various medical procedures at hospitals and healthcare offices around the state. We'd like to hear from you. What would you want to be able to find out from a database that might help inform your decision? Would you use it, or are there other benchmarks that you find more helpful? Maybe what your doctor says, who your doctor recommends is important to you. Give us a call at 1-800-639-2211 with your thoughts. Again, that's 1-800-639-2211. You can also post your questions and comments on the Vermont Edition page at vpr.net. I'm joined now by Falco Schilling, Consumer Affairs Advocate with the Vermont Public Interest Research Group, or VPIRG, and Michael Del Treco, Vice President of the Vermont Association of Hospitals and Healthcare Systems. Welcome to the program, both of you.
Thank you.
Thanks for having me.
So let's get into some possible ways that a system like this could work or not work, depending on your perspective. Falco Schilling, maybe you could start first about what you think this would be used for and how it might be helpful to consumers.
I think this could be a really helpful tool for a lot of consumers, especially those who have to interact with the health system on a regular basis. This would give them the ability to go online and do some comparison shopping between different providers and then make some more informed decisions about their health care costs and where and when they're going to get care.
And what about you, Michael Del Treco?
I said certainly an important part of the conversation. And first, let me structure some of my points around what Vermont Hospital's principles are. We're really focused on creating universal access, creating affordability, and preserving and increasing the quality. There's no one magic bullet or answer to these questions. Certainly, an important part of the conversation is transparency and price transparency. Our organization is certainly part of the primary working on some of the primary advocacy around healthcare reform, and certainly pursuing some of these very similar objectives.
But bottom line, do you think it's helpful to have a database like this that consumers could use individually to check out price comparisons?
Certainly. And I think one of the points that were made by the Auditor Hoffer is to what extent the information will be available. If it's a general ballpark, sort of directionally correct, will that be enough? If it's not, if the consumer needs more than that, it's a very complex system that we'll be looking to try to build. Something that my organization and the member hospitals would certainly embrace and be willing to participate in.
You mean so if it were something like where Auditor Hoffer was talking about, I get to go to the website, I can put in my own details, my own insurance coverage, what my deductible is, what my premium is, and then figure out specifically at any given place what it is likely to cost me.
Certainly. I mean, when you think about the complexities of what we just talked about, you have a system that needs to understand status changes, needs to understand where you are in your deductible. Certainly not maybe the broad brushstroke of what New Hampshire did, but we're looking for precision. And if we're looking for precision, we don't want to just do this with flipping a switch and saying it's done. We're talking about delivering health care to patients. We need to get this right. It's just not let's make transparency happen.
Falco Schilling, what do you think about that? I mean, the idea that we need to be very specific if it's going to be actually useful to consumers and useful and helpful to providers.
Well, I think the system that you described is what we'd ultimately want to be getting to, where people could log in, put in their personalized insurance information, and find out exactly where they are within that year, how much of their deductible they have left. But as a start, I think it'd be really helpful for people to be able to look at that information and say, here's what my insurer's negotiated with this specific provider, and then be able able to make some comparisons about providers across the state and where they might be able to go to get that care that they need. And I think that's a good first step, and I think the system we discussed earlier is exactly where we want to be getting to.
So you're okay with a more broad, more generalized system at the start if then it leads to something bigger, but you'd be okay with having something more along the lines of New Hampshire and something more generally that says for here for these common procedures, this is a ballpark of what you might expect.
Yeah, I think that's a good start. And looking at what New Hampshire did that and is currently working on is a place to start and some place we can go from it and improve upon, because that does allow consumers more information than they have now. It's very hard right now to find out what procedures might cost. And I've talked with some folks over the last couple of days since we've been talking more about this. And they say, yeah, this would be great. I've had X, Y, or Z procedure recently, and I really wish I knew going into it what it might cost me. I was waiting to get the bill. Luckily, they said that they were pleasantly surprised. But that's some angst that we'd like to be able to help deal with and help people make more informed decisions.
Let's go to what some of our listeners are curious about or talking about here. Brandy says, the problem with price transparency is that even if a consumer knows what a specific facility is going to charge for a particular procedure, it's nearly impossible to know what the insurance company is going to allow. The pricing for healthcare overall is completely opaque, and suggesting that a consumer can navigate the price structures in such a way as to choose the best quality at the best price is absurd. What do you think about that, Michael Del Trecco?
Well, I would say, Brandy, you're really talking about peeling this back and talking about the complexities. Falco mentioned that it would be great to understand provider contractual relationships with insurers. As soon as you take that next step, it's very complex. To back up and bring it up a level, I agree, and many of our principles are steeped in how can we provide and deliver the best quality care, provide as much information to patients that is possible at the time. I know in many instances our members work with individuals to navigate, help them get information from insurance companies, really understand the nouns and verbs and help them get the answers they need in advance. Completely agree with the question.
And let's go to Jeanette, who's calling in from Putney. Hi, Jeanette. You're on the air.
Hi, Jane. Hi, Doug. I've been working on healthcare issues for a long time, and as consumers, I think that we need to make sure that consumers know what they're getting and what they're paying for and what it's going to cost. But as a state and working on this, we need to be really careful that we understand that how hospitals work. And you may have touched on this in our last two speakers. I didn't hear the whole thing. Hospitals have to maintain a complete infrastructure, emergency rooms, the beds in case they need them, all the infrastructure. And there are many of those that cost a lot of money that the hospital can't recoup. So they recoup it on what are called profit centers. And unfortunately, what's happening is a lot of private groups are now pulling those profit centers, setting up competition to those profit centers as for-profit clinics. And the fear is that the hospital budgets will be undermined. And I think we need to be, as a state, we need to be very, very careful that we do not allow that to happen, because the hospitals have to maintain the aftercare, they have to maintain emergency rooms and all of that. So that's what I wanted to throw out that thought.
And Jeanette, you say you've been working on this. Is this Senator Jeanette White?
It is.
Oh, great. Okay. Well, let me pose your question to Michael Del Trecco about what you're saying here about, you know, hospitals and profit centers. What do you think?
Interesting dynamic. I mean, when I think about what was discussed, the limited profitable procedures that are done in organizations are becoming more finite. The overhead, the existing infrastructure remains. In Vermont, we happen to have 8 critical access hospitals, very important to our delivery system. They're small, 25-bed organizations, run 24/7 emergency rooms 365 days a year, have nurses, doctors on call, very, very complicated part of the equation. So as we move forward, the undermining or the potential of washing away those profit centers, whether it be in a fee-for-service system, which our organizations and members are on board of moving away from. We actually think that's a big problem in our system. So as we move towards more consistent payments or pricing. What we need to focus on is identifying true cost and paying for those services and recognizing the overhead we want in our infrastructure. If we don't need or don't want services, that might be one thing. But the population really and the people of Vermont really need services in the communities that they live in.
Let's jump into one more listener comment, and then, Falco, I want to bring you back into the conversation. Dorothy's calling in from Waterville. Hi, Dorothy. Go ahead.
Hi. I have a question and then a comment, and then I'll hang up and listen to the response on the radio. The question I'd like to ask is, what is the opportunity for individuals to negotiate prices for procedures? You mentioned that some procedure might be $10,000 and the insurance company pays it at $7,000 in full. Couldn't your database list that X procedure is $10,000, Blue Cross allows $7,000, MVP allows $7,500, and that gives the individual some base for bargaining? Mm-hmm. That's a very difficult thing to do in this system, and I'm sure it's part of why you're looking at making costs more transparent. My comment is that people who have insurance provided by the state are often viewed as abusing the system, going to emergency rooms for care and things like that, but they receive no bills. So they have absolutely no clue, and I've tested this with people I know who have state insurance, they have absolutely not a single idea of how much any particular thing is charged for and how much is then paid. And I really believe that if people with state insurance knew that their strep throat, which was treated at the primary care doctor's for $50, is going to be charged $300 in the ER, they'd find a way to help lower the cost.
Well, Dorothy, interesting comments you have there. I appreciate that perspective. And we're going to leave your comment there to sit, because I hear what you're saying. But I want to pose your question to Falco Schilling about, would a database like this allow individual consumers who may not have insurance, as Dorothy said, or might have an insurance with a very high deductible and be paying quite a lot out of pocket, would something like this, in your opinion, allow individuals to have the ability to negotiate better than they do now?
Well, I think that a database like this would let consumers know what the prices that different insurers have negotiated. Generally, if you are an insurance plan, they're going to be doing the negotiation for you. But for people who don't have insurance, many of our hospitals across the state either have reduced care packages or free care packages. And that's something you can find out, I believe, on the Department of Financial Regulation's website. They have some links to that. And it varies from hospital to hospital. And I think that would be an option that would give you some more information to begin that negotiation, and I think that could be helpful to consumers.
For both of you, do you see something like this having any effect on the cost of healthcare? If consumers can basically let market forces take control in some ways by saying, I might pay less for a procedure if I go here, so I'm going to go here, do you see that having any impact on the overall cost of healthcare in terms of bringing it down? Michael Del Treco?
I think it's one component that must be baked in together with other variables. The larger piece to me is driving efficiency, looking at driving waste out, looking at things like readmissions, looking at quality of care. And with those increased intensity and looking at those areas, I think that's where most efficiencies will be had.
So that's where you see the healthcare costs going down more than consumer choice.
Certainly a big piece of consumer decision-making is price. So that will have an effect, but I think the larger component is certainly the efficiency discussion.
Falco Schilling?
I think it will have a big impact on what the prices consumers are paying themselves. As the auditor said, more than a third of Vermonters now have high deductible health plans where they're paying a significant amount of money out of pocket before they're getting any coverage from their insurers. And so this would really help them make more informed decisions. When you're looking at thousands of dollars out of pocket, that can make a huge difference in where and when you're going to get care. So I think it'd be helpful in that aspect.
Well, we've got a long way to go before we get to any kind of database like the one that we've been talking about now, but I appreciate your perspective on where we're heading as a state and what effect you think it might have. Falco Schilling is a consumer affairs advocate with the Vermont Public Interest Research Group. Michael Del Treco is vice president of the Vermont Association of Hospitals and Healthcare Systems. Thanks again very much.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you so much.
Coming up, we're going to hear from the widow of journalist Michael Hastings. She has just shepherded through publication his tour de force novel about the nature of journalism with the backdrop of the U.S. war in Iraq. This is Vermont Edition. Welcome back to Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. When journalist Michael Hastings died in a car crash a year ago, he left a legacy as a tough war reporter. Hastings might best be remembered for a Rolling Stone article he wrote in 2010 about U.S. General Stanley McChrystal. The article led to the general's resignation. On that reporting trip to Kabul, he met Elise Jordan, and they were married 6 months later. Now, a year after her husband's death, Jordan has ushered through publication a novel that he wrote a few years before he died. It's called The Last Magazine, and it's a satirical, bawdy look at magazine journalism and the Iraq War, set in the early 2000s. Jordan says she knew about the novel before her husband died and that he would want it published.
Well, I had been emailed by one of his former Newsweek colleagues, and the colleague sent me a file of the book, and I read it just in one sitting. I couldn't put it down, didn't take a single break. It just, his voice, you know, pops off the page, the funny, subversive Michael that I knew. And it's also just a really crazy story for anyone who's fascinated by the insider worlds of journalism and politics and the reality of covering war.
One of the characters in the book, one of the main characters and the narrator, is called Michael M. Hastings. And Michael, the real Michael, started as an intern at Newsweek, became a war correspondent. And it sort of describes the storylines of the two main characters in the novel. Was it difficult at all for you to separate the characters from your husband?
Not really, because it is very, I feel like it's such a vivid and imaginative story, but it, you know, certainly there were so many of his familiar themes, and, you know, the way Michael talked about the decline of print media, the way that Michael captures the insanity of media and war, the duplicity that you see at the magazine, and it just skewers the culture of establishment media elites in a way that is just so Michael and Michael's unique voice. So that was really special for me to happen upon that.
It's a really jaded look at the state of journalism. Was Michael that jaded?
Michael always called himself a cynical idealist because he could be cynical and he could be, you know, he was incredibly hard-hitting. But at the end of the day, he thought that basic compassion was the most important thing for a reporter to have. And so he did, you know, believe that, you know, there's a lot of joy in reporting and that a lot of responsibility came with it.
We're talking a little bit about some of the themes in the novel, but maybe you can tease out a couple of the narrative threads. It begins in 2002, goes into the invasion of Iraq, and ends in the winter of 2005 and early 2006, which was a particularly deadly time in Iraq. Can you talk a little bit about what's happening in the book?
So it starts out in the voice of the young intern, Michael M. Hastings at Newsweek, and, you know, starts out with this ambitious young intern who is trying to please his big editors and is doing anything he can do to please the warring editors, one of whom is Sanders Berman, a kind of waspish Southerner, and the other who is the international editor, Nishant Patel, who is Indian royalty of sorts. And well-known intellectuals, both of them. And so it tracks those two editors and what's happening at the headquarters of the magazine with what's actually happening in the field with a war correspondent, A.E. Peoria, who, as you read in the novel, has quite some adventures and some pretty wild stories from his travel abroad. But he quickly, the war correspondent Peoria, becomes jaded because he can't tell the stories that he thinks are the most important stories to tell. And so it's really, the book is just balancing integrity, balancing careerism, you know, and just really captures the insanity of media and war.
Yeah, and there is some insanity to it. It's sort of over-the-top exploits that go on, especially with A.E. Peoria, the reporter who's working abroad. But it's a kind of a fantastical read in that way.
Well, and I think that's what people have always loved so much about Michael's journalism. He was never boring. I don't think that he ever wrote a boring sentence in his life. And all of his stories, he understood, you know, what it took to tell an interesting story. And so it makes it just a really funny read. And while, you know, it does have, you know, some big themes and an important message, I would say that most of all, it's hilarious and really entertaining.
So reviewers have observed that the magazine in this book, the book is called The Last Magazine, that the magazine that's being sort of skewered is Newsweek, and that the two characters who you mentioned who are vying for control of the magazine, Nishant Patel and Sanders Berman, were modeled on Fareed Zakaria and John Meacham. And then Adam Peori wrote a piece for Slate called I Am A.E. Peoria, and he talked about how he knew Michael when Michael was an intern at Newsweek and he was a reporter. Would Michael have appreciated the media circus that's surrounding this novel about media circus inside this journalism world?
Well, and I think the response has been exactly that, which certainly he would have loved all of the buzz. Art imitating life, life imitating art. I do think, though, that the characters are, you know, I want to stress that they're composites, and Michael had an extremely vivid imagination. So I think it undersells him a little bit to say that certain characters are certain people, but definitely, you know, a very vividly rendered telling of what life is like at a news magazine.
So for you, when you read, oh, this is who that is, or this is about that particular story that happened, do you roll your eyes or do you appreciate that what he's writing about is still sort of happening in real life?
Oh, I love that it's still, that Michael's writing is still at the forefront of conversation. And, you know, something that I've been just so proud of over the past couple of weeks, especially, is how well his journalism has held up. You know, because he was such an accurate, fair reporter and had, you know, just a great vision. The story of Bo Bergdahl, the prisoner of war who recently was released by the Afghan Taliban. Michael wrote an amazing profile of Bergdahl about 2 years ago for Rolling Stone, and he thought that was the biggest story of his career and was certain that there was going to be so much media buzz surrounding it because about America's only prisoner of war. And then it kind of, people read it, thought it was a great piece, but there wasn't much of a media uproar. But that happened, you know, the past month when Bo's release finally was secured and there was the opportunity to politicize the story. And that was something Michael also predicted in the story. So I love that his work has such resonance and such staying power. And I think it's testament to his great talent as a writer.
How much editing was needed for this book before it went into publication?
Not much at all. His editor was actually really impressed by what a final draft he had, and Michael had clearly been working on it for years. He wrote the majority of it when he was in Vermont, actually, and he finished it right before he went to Afghanistan to do this profile of General Stanley McChrystal.
Yes, and that certainly made a name for him, that profile that eventually led to General McChrystal's resignation and some of the revelations that happened because of Michael's reporting. So he had sort of put this novel on the back burner after that?
He had, and the McChrystal story, I feel like the media response to the story was exactly what Michael is writing about in this book. Michael, you know, thought that perhaps the story would make waves for a day or two, but he never thought that President Obama would fire McChrystal. And Michael also thought the most important part of the story was how he depicted counterinsurgency's failure in Afghanistan, not senior staffers for the general who were criticizing the administration. And so that kind of shows, you know, how people and media seize on certain parts of a story and is really what The Last Magazine is all about.
You mentioned that Michael wrote most of the book while living in Vermont. You and he lived in Vermont for a year. What connection did he feel to Vermont?
Michael always considered Vermont his spiritual home, and we were actually planning on buying a house there right after the 4th of July last year. Unfortunately, he passed away before that had a chance to happen. But Vermont was always where he felt a refuge. He felt it was such a peaceful place. He always felt that he did his best writing there. And I think he certainly did. He wrote three of his four books while in Vermont. And I just think there's a certain independence that the people of Vermont embody that certainly Michael embodied, but that he really admired and appreciated and wanted to have in his life.
You've made sure that this novel gets published posthumously. When I was reading it, it struck me that this could be an example of a new kind of war literature. You know, the war that's happening far away that most people are only reading about through the media and through the lens of what other people have determined is important. How do you want it to be read?
I certainly appreciate that interpretation, and I think that it's absolutely true, and that's something that comes across in Michael's war reporting. You know, he is most famous for his war reporting, but if you look at how he did it and how he told the story, he always managed to talk about what was happening on the ground in the war zone, but also how the policy was being made in Washington and how bureaucracy affected the lives of millions of people around the world. And so I think, yes, definitely showing the inner workings is a powerful, powerful message of Michael's.
What's it like for you to do interviews like this about your husband's work?
Well, I've been, to be totally honest, I was so nervous about the book and having to, you know, speak publicly about Michael because I hadn't since he passed away. And clearly it's very emotional for me. But it's been, you know, I couldn't be more proud of how everyone has received the novel, of how people are remembering Michael and keeping his memory and his work alive. And I think, unfortunately, his life was cut way too short. And, robbed of him. But he accomplished so much in such a short amount of time. And there are just some people who burn with such passion and have so much natural talent and brilliance. And Michael was certainly one of those individuals who lived his life and made a real impact.
Elise Jordan was the wife of journalist and Vermonter Michael Hastings, who died a year ago. His novel is called The Last Magazine. Elise, thank you so much for talking to us about the work and about your husband, Michael.
No, thanks for listening, and thanks to everyone in Vermont for all the support.
Michael Hastings was 33 years old. His nonfiction books are I Lost My Love in Baghdad, The Operators, and Panic 2012. His novel, The Last Magazine, was published last month. A brief note that you should be aware, it does contain sexually explicit material that may not be suitable for all readers. For your messages. Producer Sage Van Wing joins me. Hi, Sage.
Hi, Jane. Recently, we talked about the market for first-time job seekers, and we asked you what you learned from your first job. Paul in Warren wrote, I got a position as a draftsman in the engineering department of a Detroit diesel dealership in the Bay Area. The first year went well, and I was rehired the next summer, but unfortunately, another fellow also materialized who, like me, sported a beard. We were soon given an ultimatum that we either shave or not return to work. Being young and idealistic, the decision was relatively easy for me, but the other guy had a wife and a new baby to consider.
What I learned, writes Paul, was that employers can be capricious, unfair, and prejudiced in their dealings with employees, which I don't suppose was the lesson they wanted to teach us, but I do remember it to this day.
And last week, we discussed a new report from Vermont Legal Aid, which shows that rental discrimination continues to be a problem in this state. Lauren emailed to ask, if you advertise a house or apartment for rent and say up front, no smoking, no pets or kids, is that in violation of the laws?
One of our guests on that show was Angela Zykowski, owner of the Vermont Apartment Owners Association, and she responded to Lauren saying, you can advertise no smoking and no pets, with a caveat on no pets, that if someone applies with an assistance animal, you may have to make an exception to the no pets policy. Advertising no kids is not allowed under fair housing laws, nor is making a decision based on whether or not someone has kids.
And Angela goes on, many times landlords have safety concerns about renting to people with children, i.e. property near railroad tracks or next to a river. But it's the tenant's decision to make about whether or not they're concerned about those potential safety issues.
Last Friday, we spoke with Lewis Porter, the new director of the Vermont Department of Fish and Wildlife, Among other issues, we discussed the fact that the number of people who fish and hunt have been declining, meaning that the department has less revenue from the sale of licenses. Cammie wrote, "I have found that many wildlife management areas in the northwestern and western part of the state are virtually inaccessible to foot traffic. The trails are overgrown. I'm a birder, and in lieu of a hunting license, would readily contribute to a fund to improve foot access."
And Jim wrote, "Let's consider an annual registration fee for kayaks, canoes, stand-up paddle boards, etc. I believe that most of us paddlers would agree that it's only reasonable for us to pay a share for maintaining our lakes, streams, and rivers."
Finally, we're still getting emails about our earlier discussion on healthcare pricing transparency and what the state might be able to do in terms of a database that could be accessible to consumers so you could do some comparison shopping. Richard says this is a start, but in order for the insurance companies to truly work in a free market, their monopoly needs to be removed. We should be able to buy insurance in any state. If we need a procedure, it can be done in any state, including overseas. Let the free market work. All right, you can let us know what you think about all of the issues we discuss on this program or just about the show itself. Tweet us or Facebook us at Vermont Edition.
Or just send us an email, vermontedition@vpr.net.
Thanks a lot, Sage.
You're welcome, Jane.
Moving on to tomorrow's program, you know, during the summertime, it can be difficult to find a way to keep the kids entertained, especially as this long weekend approaches. You might be looking for some interesting programming. Tomorrow, we're going to talk to museums around the state about the summer programs they offer, from evenings at the circus to veterinarian camps. And we'll take a look at what you can learn from participating. Send us your favorite museum education experiences. Write to vermontedition@vpr.net and then tune in for the discussion tomorrow at noon. Vermont Edition is produced by Patty Daniels, Rick Singeri, and Sage Van Wing, with production assistance from Catherine Hayes. Mary Williams directed the show, and our executive producer is John Van Hoosen. I'm Jane Lindholm. Thanks for listening.